kingdom of heaven will be like a man going on a journey, who calls his servants and entrusts his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey.
The man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more.
So also, the one who with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more.
But the man who received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money.
After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them.
The man who had received 5 bags of gold drew out the other 5. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with the 5 bags of gold. See, I have gained 5 more."
His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness."
The man with 2 bags of gold also came. "Master," he said, "you have entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more."
His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness."
Then the man who received 1 bag of gold came. "Master," he said, "I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you."
His master replied, "You wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well, then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw the worthless servant outside into the darkness, where they will be weeping and gnashing of teeth."
Who are the sharks? They're self-made millionaire and billionaire investors who are entrepreneurs themselves. Kevin O'Leary is a venture capitalist who turned a $10,000 loan into a software business worth $4.2 billion. Barbara Corcoran went from working as a waitress in Manhattan to building the city's preeminent real estate empire. Damon John is a fashion and branding expert who grew his homegrown clothing line into the globally recognized fashion brand FUBU. Robert Herjavec, the son of an immigrant factory worker, is now a technology mogul who sold his first internet companies for over $350 million. And Mark Cuban, notorious billionaire entrepreneur and the outspoken owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
All right, so it's 6:31 Sunday. Let's give a big round of applause for all our helpers this morning. You guys have been great. But we're also in a series right now called A Life That Counts. We're looking at how we can take the things that we've been given and make the most out of them. Last week, Pastor Josh talked about making the most of our time. Today, we're talking about making the most of our talent. And next week, we're going to be talking about making the most of our treasure or our money. Time, talent, and treasure. A life that counts. Now, you might be wondering why I started off with the intro to Shark Tank. Because it's awesome. But it fascinates me. The thing about it that fascinates me is you've got these people, these sharks. Now, they're very wealthy people, but they all started out with so little. You know, Barbara Corcoran, she was a waitress in Manhattan, and she turned what she had into this huge real estate empire. Or Damon John, he started a little clothing company from his garage, and it's become FUBU. Robert Herjavec, the son of an immigrant factory worker, has now become this big deal. Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful, they call him. He's not so wonderful. But he has He took a $10,000 loan. He turned it into this big business and sold it for millions of dollars. And then, you know, they have these people that have these ideas, and they come pitch them to the sharks and try and get the sharks to invest. So the sharks are these really fascinating people. They take so little and they turn it into so much. Except Mark Cuban, he's a rich guy. He's always been rich. He kind of ruins the illustration. But either way, it's fascinating. And they start the show like this because it grabs your attention. I think in general, we're all pretty fascinated with that concept. Starting with a little and turning it into something big. And at the same time, I think all of us can agree that when we see wasted opportunities, when we see wasted talent, when we see wasted chances, we all kind of cringe. It's hard for us to watch. I'm sure you've watched a movie or something where you're watching the main character and you know if he'll go through that door, right? Or if he'll just say that one thing to the girl, or if he'll just do this one thing, then everything will change. But he doesn't do it, and you're like, ah, because the waste is just overwhelming. It's hard. It makes us all cringe. I love basketball. I grew up loving basketball, and I was also really fascinated, probably more than fascinated, probably a little obsessed with the idea of dunking a basketball. It was the coolest thing to me ever. Now, you probably never realized this, but I'm rarely the tallest person in the room. So when I was in, you know, elementary school or maybe even middle school, when I would meet somebody that was really tall, I'd introduce myself, and right away I would say, "Hey, I'm Luke. Can you dunk?" And that was like the first question. This is true. You can ask my family. And if they could dunk, they were like my hero. And if they couldn't, I would just be like, so depressed, because I felt like, you're so tall. How can you not dunk? You know, and I'm if you're tall and you can't dunk, I'm not trying to make you feel bad. But I mean, come on. But it's this idea, this, you know, to me that was such a waste, because I wish I was tall. I'm a basketball player, right? Whatever. Anyway, so we love the idea of maximizing little, and we can't stand the idea of wasting what we've been given. We're looking at wasted talent this morning. How do we avoid wasted talent? Or better yet, how do we maximize? How do we make the most of what we've been given, whether it's big or little? And this morning, I want to give you three keys, three principles that I think will help us to make the most of what we've been given. If you're a church person and you're totally sold out on this whole thing, I think this will be really helpful. And I think even if you don't consider yourself a religious person, if you'll grasp these principles, they'll help you make the most of what you've been given. So our fantastic students have just read the parable of the talents. Now, right away, that creates some confusion, because in the culture that Jesus was speaking to, a talent, when a talent was given, he wasn't talking about giving somebody the ability to juggle or the ability to walk a tightrope or something like that. He was giving them money. A talent was a form of money. So what happened was, there's this master, clearly a wealthy master. He leaves town and he entrusts his money to his servants. Now, the New Testament was originally written in Greek, as many of you know, and the word for servant there is doulos, or doulos. That would more accurately be translated slave. So these slaves were owned by their master. They probably owned nothing, and their master entrusts them with talents, with money. Some modern translations call this the parable of the bags of gold, because it helps to clear up that confusion. Now, a talent, if you worked a day's wage in that culture, you would earn one denarius for working a day. A talent was 10,000 denarii. So these servants, these slaves, they were not given just a few coins. They were given a ton of money. You can do the math in your head if you want. One commentator says a talent is probably equivalent to about $60,000 today. So even the guy who got one talent was still given $60,000, roughly, about that. And the master leaves. He goes on a journey. He says, here, take this and make the most of it. And one guy, the first guy with five, he gets to work and he multiplies those talents. He multiplies those money. He's working. The same thing with the guy who was given two talents. He's working and working. And the guy with one talent realizes, I've only got one talent. And he takes it and he buries it in a hole. That might sound crazy to you and I, bury money in a hole. But in that culture, they didn't have secure bank accounts like we do, where you could just keep all your money in some, you know, safe, secure storage area. You kind of had to protect what you have. So he buries it. Now, if you're a slave and your master goes away for a long time, you're left with nothing to do. So while these other servants, these other slaves are working tirelessly and budgeting and maybe starting businesses and doing whatever they needed to do to multiply their talents, the guy with one is just hanging out, doing nothing. He's decided to bury his one talent. So when the master comes back to see what they've done after being gone for a long time, The guy who started with five talents says, I've turned that five talents into 10. Here you go. And the master says, great job. Enjoy this with me. The guy with two talents says, okay, you've given me the two talents I've worked, and I've gotten you two more. The master says, well done, good and faithful servant. Enjoy this with me. And then he goes over to the one, and the one master, the last servant, he blames what he's done on his master. He says, you're a harsh man. And I didn't want to risk losing what you gave me, so I just bury it. And here, he says, take what's yours. And the master, knowing what's been going on, knowing the servant, the slave, has been doing nothing, he says, you wicked and lazy servant. So that's our parable that we're looking at today. I told you there's three keys. So in light of that, I want us to look at three keys to maximizing what we've been given, maximizing the talents, the gifts, the opportunities that we have. The first key to doing that is understanding, is seeing that this is a privilege, seeing that this is a privilege. When you look at this story, this parable, for us, most of us, or for me at least, the people that stand out in the story are the servant with the five and the servant with the one talent, right? The guy with the five, he did the good, he worked hard, he did a good job, he's a good guy, great. The guy with the one talent, he didn't do anything, he was bad. Those are the two people that stand out to me. But if you're around when Jesus is telling the story and you hear Jesus say this, the guy that's going to stand out to you in the story is the master. This master has given these slaves the opportunity of a lifetime. A slave could have spent their lives doing chores, washing the master's feet, doing the little menial tasks in households. A lot of slaves were totally mistreated. And here this master says, I am trusting you guys with my wealth, with a lot of money. Go. Go live a life, buy, sell, trade. Go make the most of what I'm giving you. He's giving them an incredible opportunity. You can't miss the overwhelming generosity of this master here. He's giving them a privilege they would have never had, the opportunity of a lifetime. And for us too, we need to understand the privilege that we've been given. Here's what I mean. Every other religion, every other faith out there, it has this idea, it's built on this idea of keeping peace with God. I do the good things to make God happy with me, and we're trying to keep the peace here. When, you know, if I don't do the right thing, if I mess up, I don't treat someone, well, then I'm not good with God, so I got to earn my way back to being good with Him, because I got to manage that, I got to keep peace with God. That's how just about every other religion out there works. And even if we're not careful, even some of us Christians live like that. We think when we're doing well, God's happy with us, great. We've got a gold star on our heavenly chore chart. But when we're not doing well, well, God's, you know, he must not be, I know he loves me, but, you know, he probably doesn't like me right now because I'm not doing the right thing. But Jesus took this idea and he flipped it totally upside down. What Jesus said was basically what he did. He died on the cross. You've probably heard that. And then he came back to life 3 days later. And because he did that, Paul writes in Romans, you now have peace with God. You are good with God. You are free. That's what grace is. It means you don't have to sit there worrying, well, how does God see me? How does God understand me now? God sees you the same way he saw his son Jesus. Pastor Josh said a couple weeks ago, we've been given credit for the work that Jesus has done. So therefore, Paul writes, we have peace with God. We've been given the privilege now. While everyone else is worried about, oh, how am I? How is God? How am I accepted? Am I not accepted? It's a me-oriented way of life. You're constantly worrying about what God thinks of you. But Jesus is saying, you don't have to. That's what grace is. You're okay. You're good with God. And now you have the privilege of being others-oriented instead of being me-oriented. You're free. You're free. The Apostle Paul writes, because you've been made free from the law, from right and wrong, from good and bad, take that freedom. And don't just continue to do whatever you want, even though you could. He says, take that freedom and serve one another in love. Be others-oriented. And when we grasp this, it will totally change the way we use our time, our talents, our treasure, our opportunities, our gifts, our strengths. This is an incredible privilege. And this is why the Jesus movement, the early church that we've been talking about in our Unstoppable series, this is why it was unstoppable, because those people were so others oriented. They were selling their goods. They were giving up all that they had for other people because they knew that God was taking care of them. They understood it was a privilege to have the God of the universe, the creator of the universe, providing for their needs. It's a privilege. It's a privilege to be able to be others oriented instead of being me oriented. We have a privilege of spending our talents for that cause. A basketball coach once taught me, there are five guys on a court on your team. And if every one of those guys is looking out for themselves, trying to have the best game they can possibly have, making themselves as good as they can possibly be, then each guy on the court has one guy looking out for their best, right? It's them. But if every player on the team decides to make it their goal to make every other player on their team, those four other guys, the best that they can be, then each individual person has four people looking out for their best. It's a profound principle. It changed the way my basketball team played with each other, and I never forgot it. And that was the mentality of the early church. They were others-oriented, and it was a privilege. They loved it. Could you imagine if that's the way that we lived? Constantly focus on other people, and that's a privilege. I want to show you a picture of a sandcastle. See this? Pretty amazing. I built this. No, I didn't. I didn't build this. All right, here's another one. This is the White House, if you can see it. It's a sandcastle. It's the White House. I guess it's the sand house. Next. This is a sand sculpture. It's made of sand. It's a dentist pulling a tooth. Pretty amazing. Now, I'm very impressed with this, but to be honest, I don't get it. I don't understand why people would spend so much time, all their talents, on something like this. Some three-year-old comes running down the beach, and that's the end of this guy, right? Instead, I'd rather invest my energy in building a skyscraper, you know, or a sculpture, or something that's going to live on. When you're living a me-oriented life, the end of your life is the end of all your investments. If you're living for others, if you're living an others-oriented life, you're building something that will live on. past you. And it's a privilege. I went to the Nascake school right down the road in Setauket. We had a holiday boutique when I was younger. I mean, you can't hold this story against me, okay? But my parents gave me some money, and I'm sure they remember this, to go buy gifts for my brother and sister and for my parents. So on Christmas morning, I'd have something to give. And one year, I went to the holiday boutique, and I spent all the money that my mom had given me, and I came home with gifts. But all the gifts were for me. One thing that I bought was this metal balancing man. Come on, it was pretty cool, right? And my parents weren't happy when I came home. I told them, you know, they were a little bit surprised. Wow, you bought all this stuff for yourself and whatever. And they could have taught me a really hard lesson. Fortunately, they let me get gifts for my siblings and for the rest of my family. But they could have just let me keep what I had, keep the money, the things that I bought with the money I spent on myself. And I can't really imagine how painful it would have been Christmas morning when my brother and my sister are giving each other gifts and everyone's exchanging gifts. And I've got nothing to offer because I spent it all on myself. And my hope is that none of us will get to a place in our lives where we look around and feel like everything I had, all my gifts and talents, and I spent on myself. It's a privilege. It's a privilege. When you look at living for other people, is it a have to or is it a get to? Is it a have to or is it a get to? This is where the third servant in our parable gets into trouble. When he goes to speak to the master, he says, I see you as a harsh master. And because of that, I buried your money in a hole. And he says, take what is yours. Have what is yours. That's a Greek expression. It's basically saying, it's not my responsibility anymore. Have it back. He's saying, I'm done with it. You see, he saw what he was given as a burden instead of a privilege. He had the opportunity to go buy and sell and make the most of what he had been given. But he didn't. He saw it as a burden. And this is where we get into trouble. Do you see God as a harsh master? Or as someone that's given you the opportunity of a lifetime? Someone that set you free because of what Jesus has done. Set you free from that law of right and wrong, so you have the privilege of living for other people. I heard a pastor say, Andy Stanley said this, I was listening to it a week or two ago, and I've been wrestling with it since. He said, if your faith, if your Christian faith does not give you a sense of freedom, then you're doing it wrong. Then you've missed it. You've misunderstood what grace is all about. So we need to understand, we need to see the privilege. Secondly, we need to know our power. Know your power. I'm going with all P's here, okay? But what I mean is you need to understand the tools that you've been given, the gifts you have, your personality. You need to know what you've been given to work with. In our parable, the master could have very easily said to his servants, go out and make money. But he didn't. He said, here's something to work with. Use that. In the same way, Jesus has given us strengths, gifts, abilities to work with. Sorry. If you've been to a college and career lunch here, you know that Lexi Heilman has the gift of hospitality. She's an excellent host. My mom is the same way. She has the gift of hospitality. Some people don't. Some people aren't. And that's okay. Pastor Josh clearly has the gift of teaching. Some people don't, and that's okay. We have different jobs. We have different strengths. But we all make up one big body. In his letter to the Corinthian church, Paul writes this. He says, just as the body, physical body, though it's one, it has many parts. Each part has a different function. So it is with Christ. In our body, in our church body, each one of us has a different function. He then goes on to say, if the whole body were an eye, if the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell come from? Each job, each role has a specific job. He says, but in fact, God has placed the parts of the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? But as it is, we are one body with many parts. My wife, Allie, she's really good at details. She can plan everything out. I am more of a big picture, more strategic, more, if we're going on a trip, I'll do the travel plans, figure out, you know, which roads we got to hit at what times, whatever. That's my strength. Allie is all about lists and packing, and when she's getting ready to pack, the whole house is like, you know, she's got all these lists or whatever. When I have to pack, I just open my drawer, pick everything up, and just drop it in, right? I had to go on a staff retreat a couple of months ago, and Allie couldn't go, so I had to pack myself. And I'm the guy, I was in the shower drying off with my bed sheet because I hadn't packed a towel. That's just the way we are. But fortunately, we've recognized that. So Allie does what she's good at. I do what I'm good at. And as a church, think about how strong we would be if we were all working in the areas that we were strongest in. There's pressure in our society to be a jack of all trades. There's a book, it's called Strength Finders. It's written by Tom Rath. In the beginning, he says, our goal was to start a global conversation about what's right with people. We're tired of living in a world that revolved around fixing our weaknesses. Society's relentless focus on people's shortcomings has become a global obsession. Now listen to this. He says, what's more, we've discovered that people have several times more potential for growth when they invest energy in developing their strengths instead of correcting their weaknesses. Later in his study, they found out that those who were working where they were gifted or where their strengths were way more emotionally engaged in what they were doing. The same thing is true here with the church. If you volunteer at all and you leave here drained and just like, oh my gosh, I'm glad that's over, chances are you're not serving in an area that you're gifted. And somebody who is gifted in that area could be serving there. Find a place where you've been gifted, where your strengths are, and serve there. We know about this. This applies in life as well, in sports as well. If you know basketball, you've heard of Shaquille O'Neal. He's this huge guy. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame. He's amazing. Now, when he played, he never, ever shot three-pointers. Why? Because he was terrible at it. Did he spend all his time trying to get better at it? No, he didn't. Because that's not where his gift was. If he tried, so he let the other guys who could do that shoot three-pointers, and he would stay under the basket because he was a monster and he dominated everybody that came down there. And he did what he could do well. In Ephesians 4, Paul says that the church, the body, this community of Jesus followers, we will grow and build ourselves up in love as each part does its work. What if our church was filled with people serving where they're strongest? So what are your gifts? What are your weaknesses? What are your strengths? If I came up to you and I said, hey, I need somebody to do this, can you do it? Would you be able to say, yes, that's where I'm gifted, or no, I'm not gifted there? Or would you have no idea? It's important to know where you're gifted and where your strengths are. We're offering a class. It started this morning. It's called Thriving in Ministry. It's led by Randy Fowler. He just told me. It was at 9:15. He told me that 33 people in that class. That's the heartbeat of this class. We're offering the Strength Finders Assessment. We're doing the Myers-Briggs Personality Assessment. We're going to be doing Spiritual Gifts Tests. All so that you can know where God has gifted you. And you can get plugged in an area where you'll thrive. That's why we're calling it Thriving in Ministry. So I'd strongly recommend you do that. If we see the privilege we have, if we know our power, if we know our tools, that's how we'll maximize what we've been given. Last thing, our potential. We need to recognize our potential. There's our third P. Our potential to make an impact, to use what we've been given to make a difference. Personally, I believe that this is the biggest hindrance to us not getting the most out of what we've been given. I think this is the biggest hindrance. If we look at our parable, the guy who got one talent got a lot of money. He was given a lot, $60,000. I'd take that, right? But he had just watched somebody get five times more what he was given and another person get two times more. So when he was given his, he had this kind of attitude of, well, I'm only the guy with one talent. I've only been given one talent. So what does he do? He puts it away and he doesn't even use it. He was convinced that he wasn't given very much to work with. And I think that many of us, probably most of us, are convinced that we haven't been given very much to work with. We underestimate what we've been given. We've got these, I'm only, or I'm just, or I'm not. How many times have you heard yourself saying that? I can't do this. I'm not good enough. I'm not as strong as this guy. I'm not. And we make all these. It's like we're saying, well, I've only got one talent, so I'm just going to bury it in this hole. We strongly underestimate what we've been given, and when we do that, we're diminishing what God has given to us. Every decision you make, every action has ripple effects. And I'm totally convinced that we dramatically underestimate the far-reaching effects of what we do. Dramatically underestimate the far-reaching effects. If you're a parent and you have older children and younger children, I bet you've had this conversation with the older ones where you pull them aside and you say, you have no idea how much he looks up to you. You have no idea how much she looks up to you. She's watching what you do. You're setting an example. You can make an impact on them. And it frustrates you because they don't see it. They don't understand the impact they could have on their younger brother or their younger sister or whatever it might be. And I think that God looks at us and sees us the same way and says, you have no idea. You have, if only you would grasp the impact you can have on the people around you, because you're being watched, especially if you call yourself a Christian. When Pastor Matt Woodley first came here to the church, I was in grade school, and he had a son, his name was John, and him and I were the same age. We still are the same age, actually. And I remember, I had never met a pastor before. Up until I was in kindergarten, my family had a very Catholic background, and I knew about priests. I didn't know any priests, but I knew about them. I knew a little bit about pastors. I didn't know any of them, so I was going to a pastor's house, and it freaked me out. I was watching everything he did. I could tell you that night for dinner, we ate fried chicken and drank milk, and that was weird to me. But I also noticed how much time he spent with his kids. I watched everything that he did. It's a silly example, but I don't think we realize that God has given us a platform and we're being watched. We have the potential to make a huge difference. Some of our platforms are big, some of them are small, but my guess is that your platform, your potential to make an impact, is probably far bigger than you think it is. It's probably far bigger than you think it is. My cousin, Dan Hickey, I didn't have an older brother. So he was. I looked up to him. And in my high school, there were good kids, and then there were other kids that they weren't bad kids. They just made bad decisions. There was kind of this divide. You know, the one group didn't really like the other group, and, you know, they never really worked together. But my cousin Dan was definitely one of the good kids. But he got along with all of the other kids, all the kids from the other group. He never did what they did. He never gave in to the pressure, but they all loved him. They all respected him. And when they were going to do something that he, like, was not okay with, he had this way of kind of getting out of it and not making anybody feel judged. He had this amazing way about him, and it made an impression on me. And for years, I watched him. I watched him deal with people. He worked at a restaurant that my sister and I worked at. We would talk about how Dan was reacting to the people and what was going on in the kitchen. And he was my role model, and he never knew. I told him that later on, after I was in college. I said, oh, yeah, I used to look up to you. And he had no idea. In the same way, unfortunately, it works the opposite as well. You may be not making a good impact on people and not realizing it. Spoke to Danielle Kajiga, she's our church administrator, about this, and she said, oh yeah, before I became a Christian, I worked with a Christian. And I thought he was kind of weird, he did this, he did that, he did whatever. And she started going on, and I'm sure he had no idea the impact she was making on him. I'm sure he had no idea. She had no idea the impact he was making on her. It works both ways. We need to realize that we have a platform. The people that use their platforms the best are the ones that realize they have potential to make a difference. You have a platform with your children, a huge one. You have a platform with your coworkers. You have a platform with your family members, your extended family members. You have a platform with your cleaning staff at work. You have a platform with everybody you come into contact with. And it's bigger than you think it is. There was a student at my high school. Him and I didn't get along. I wasn't really very nice when I was a sophomore, junior. I had some serious issues, and me and this guy butt heads. And I went to this youth meeting, and at this point in my life, I felt like were all kind of crumbling. My relationship at home wasn't that great. I was making a lot of really bad decisions. I was just kind of in a dark stage of my life. And I remember this one night, I was at this, we called it Driven. It was a student-led youth ministry led by this guy, Josh, who was a great guy. But at the time, like I said, I didn't like him. And we had this prayer time, and the music was on. I had my hands in my face, and he came up to me, and he said, hey, are you all right? And I didn't answer him. And he said, can I pray for you? And I didn't answer him. And in that moment, he could have said, I'm not even this guy's friend. Or I'm just a year older than him. Or I'm only another student. He doesn't even like me. He had a million reasons to take his little bag of gold, his little one talent, his influence, and bury it in his proverbial hole. But instead he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, God, I don't really know what's bothering Lou right now, but it seems like he's in some trouble. Would you help him out? And he began to pray for me. And that night made a huge impact on me. Huge impact on him. He could have made every excuse to do nothing, but he didn't. He used what he was given. So I'll ask you this question. Where are your I'm only, I'm just, and I'm nots? Where have you buried your bags of gold? Maybe it's at work. I'm just a receptionist. Or I'm only the boss. They only listen to me because they have to. Maybe it's at home. My kids don't even listen to me. We don't even get along. Maybe you don't, but they're watching you. Maybe it's with your extended family. Oh, they think that we're weird because we became Christians. They don't want anything to do with us. They don't like what we're doing. Maybe they don't, but they're still watching you. They're watching how you deal with conflict. They're watching how you deal with difficulty. They know. And they know you're Christians. Maybe it's with your friends. I know a couple, when they became Christians, their friends kind of stepped back because they thought, oh, they're religious now. We don't really want to hang out with them. So they kind of stepped away. And that couple was just kind of like, okay, I guess if they want to do that, they can. And then years later, one of the friends called up this couple and said, I've developed cancer. And I know that you know God. I know that you pray. Can you help me? This couple had a platform, and they had no idea that they had this platform. You have a platform. It's way bigger than you think. Just watch this quick video for a second.
For years, Tinny Davidson has waved at students as they walk to the nearby high school. And today she learned just how much her simple act has meant to those going by. Kendall Hansen has the story.
If you walk by Tinny Davidson's home, there's a good chance you may see her gregarious smile and enthusiastic wave. It's something students walking to and from Highland Secondary have noticed, and the wave has become part of their daily routine.
I just like the look of the children, and they were And they all looked in, and I thought, well, if they're looking in, I'll wave to them. And that's how it started.
Seems like all the kids always wave at her.
Yeah. At first, it was pretty strange, so, you know, you wave back, but then it started to become a thing.
Tinny and her late husband, Ken Davidson, started waving at the passing kids when they moved to this home in 2007. A couple of years ago, Ken passed away, but Tinny has continued what had become their tradition.
I love it. And they seem to like it also. So, you know, it's been a fun few years.
The students feel likewise, and so this Valentine's Day, the school invites Tinny to an assembly, and she has no idea what she is in for. A rock star welcome. Student-made Valentine's. And a video of thanks for all the waves.
She waves at me every day as I walk to school, and you can always count on her to be that warm smile on a dreary day. She does it on your way to school, and she does it at lunch, and she does it after school.
She's just one of those people who's like pumping everyone's attitude up. It makes everyone's day a little bit brighter.
I'm overwhelmed by all of this. Wonderful.
A reminder that seemingly small gestures can make a big impact. On behalf of all the hearts you've warmed, Tinny Davidson, happy Valentine's Day.
All right, how about this? Is this working? All right, that's nice. Okay, so since it's 6:31 Sunday, we have a little tradition here. We like to honor our graduating seniors. So would all of the graduating seniors please rise? There's one. If you were here last year, you might remember that we had at least 10 or 11 graduating seniors. This is Sam Mancuso, and she was close friends with just about every one of the students that graduated. And this year, when the year began, she realized that all her close friends were gone. And she had a choice. She could stick around and make the most of what she's been given, live this year for the youth group being others-oriented instead of me-oriented. And fortunately for us, Sam stuck around and came just about every week when she could with a smile on her face, greeting new kids as they came in, bringing the energy level a little bit higher every Wednesday. And we're thankful for that. So she is an incredible example of how to make the most of what you've been